Next on this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, visions of sugar plums dance in our heads with Sucre chef Tarek Hanna.
So the study of crystallization, which is a very new study considering, is probably one of the most dynamic elements of what makes the structure of chocolate good or bad. So if you have a nice piece of chocolate that's shiny, you break it, it snaps. You put it in your mouth, it melts and it's not granular. That's because you have great crystallization.
Then, food historian Ryan Fertel debunks the myth of the 19th century praline vendor. Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Coming up next, but first, the news.
Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Sucre's chef, Tarek Hanna, is a master chocolatier who recently traveled to Switzerland to create his own signature chocolate. Tarek's here to explain the whys and hows of that amazing trip. And speaking of trips, Louisiana Kitchen and Cultures editor Jill Benson transports us to Natchitoches for the Festival of Lights. 300,000 lights and meat pies, too. Then, Ryan Fertel debunks the myth of the 19th century praline vendor. Prepare for visions of sugar plums that dance in your head on this week's Louisiana Eats. That chocolate is in Tarek Hanna's blood is not far from the truth. During his childhood in Nigeria, the national cocoa processing plant was so nearby that the aroma of roasting cocoa beans was always in the air. After graduating from high school in England at the age of 15, Tarek moved to Detroit, intending to study architecture, but surprisingly found himself in culinary school, where his passion for design met pastry, and truly a star was born. In the spring of 2007, Tarek joined forces with New Orleans native restaurateur Joel Dondas to create a new one-of-a-kind pastry experience, Sucre. Most recently, Tarek has revisited his childhood passion for chocolate, this time developing his very own with master chocolatiers in Switzerland. Tarek, thanks for coming to visit us on Louisiana Eats.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Poppy.
So tell me, why did you set out to create your own chocolate?
Well, the whole chocolate thing for me was something that goes back to my childhood, and it's always been my aspiration to basically express my understanding of what I want to convey to the world as to what my perfect chocolate would be. Well, what better way to do it than actually go to the greatest chocolate makers on earth and have them understand what's going on in my head and in my palate and have them translate it for me and bring it to life.
So how did you actually set this trip up? Like, how did it begin?
Well, actually, it was a trip that's been 10 years in the making.
Ah.
I was supposed to have gone to Switzerland to Felchlin, who is this incredible, true small artisan producer. And I've used their product for several years. For probably the last 15 years, I've used Felchlin chocolate. Beautiful product, incredible people. And because of that association with the people and the true essence of who the people were and the passion that they brought to the chocolate that easily translated to the product I had always worked with is why it's the chocolate of my choice. Needless to say, there are several other phenomenal brands out there. Nobody had ever hit the mark for me. And for my palate and for my product other than Falkland. So I've been a consistent user of their product. And they had offered me the opportunity about 10 years ago to come out to the factory and basically come play with them for a few days. And I finally decided that I did need to take a little bit of a break from work and go do some work.
And so what did you leave with? What have you come away from that experience with?
It gave me a much deeper rooted passion, understanding, and admiration for every single thing that goes into the product that they make. When you think about the big producers, when you buy commercial chocolate, when I say commercial, be it Falcon or a Valrhona or a Barry Callebaut or something of that nature, you imagine these monstrous factories churning out tens of thousands of pounds of chocolate an hour. But when you saw the smaller scale that Falcon produce on at a much more frequent pace and a much more frequent time frame, it gave you a much greater appreciation of how much they produce and also the freshness and the attention of the product. They have the only scientist who received, I believe it was the first ever PhD in fat crystallization.
Wow.
Yeah.
So explain to us the importance of fat crystallization.
Fat crystallization basically is everything about chocolate. It is it's what makes chocolate or what doesn't make chocolate. Chocolate is primarily, when you think of a chocolate bar, it's primarily made up of three ingredients: cocoa solids, cocoa butter, cocoa fat. So if you have a nice piece of chocolate that's shiny, you break it, it snaps. You put it in your mouth, it melts and it's not granular. That's because you have great crystallization. Or if you have a dull piece of chocolate that when you break it, it just seems soft and it seems gritty in your mouth, you have bad crystallization. So the study of crystallization, which is a very new study considering, is probably one of the most dynamic elements of what makes the structure of chocolate good or bad. So Manfred Suter, who is the gentleman in question, every single batch of chocolate they make, every 6 hours, every single batch is tested. No matter whether they're doing a very high-end single bean origin chocolate or they're doing a utility blend, every batch of chocolate gets the same attention around the clock.
That's how you get quality.
And the thing that I learned to appreciate about them was Falkland don't own farms, mm-hmm. because they don't want to monopolize the farmers. Mm-hmm. They want the farmers to understand the true essence of what the commerce is behind what they do. So they start the farms for them. They teach them about the trade. So they buy in fair trade without having to spend $50,000 a year to get a stamp put on mm-hmm. the box. But it's the truest form of trade because they don't monopolize the farms. So the ethical approach to the farmers translates to the ethical approach of how they handle the product, translates to the ethical approach of how they handle their employees. The fact that we walked through the factory and everybody knew everybody's name, everybody knew exactly how long everybody worked at the factory.
That's very special. It really
and
is.
So it was a very, very heartwarming experience to just understand, okay, I know why I love the chocolate. It's because I see how much love goes into it. I sound like I should be a salesman for them, but...
Oh, you sound like a disciple.
I have drunk of the Kool-Aid, and I believe it.
And it was chocolate.
And it was chocolate.
So... what sort of new applications are we going to see you using now that you've had this trip?
Well, interestingly enough, I don't know yet. I brought something for you to try today, and not a lot of people get an opportunity to see this. The chocolate that we actually made was made from a brand new bean from the Creole family. So we took this bean... and we went through various stages of roasting. We then went through the conching process. And again, Falkland still use three of the original conch machines that were first invented.
And for listeners who wouldn't know what the purpose of that
is. So part of the process in fabricating chocolate and manufacturing chocolate, the most important part of developing the flavor is the conch. The conch is basically a grinding process. Mm-hmm. It's a slow grinding. Imagine taking a rolling pin back and forth over a very long period of time, very slowly. So when we go through the process of determining what roast we want to use, then we go through the milling and the grinding, we then go through the conching process, where it's a combination of taking the raw solids and the sugar, and then it's slowly back and forth over several hours. Several hours, I'm talking 12, 24, 48, up to 72 hours. But what we did was, starting at 20 hours, we started tasting, and we tasted every 6 hours. It's incredible what happens in a 6 hour period. The profile of the chocolate changes completely. So imagine this machine runs constantly for 48 hours, grinding, making it smoother, developing new characteristics, bringing out the natural fruitiness, the berryness, the citrus, whatever might come up. And until you hit that point where you know what you want the final product to be, you stop.
Now, what have you got here?
What we found to be the magic number was 48 hours. We could have gone further. I have a chocolate that I use right now from Falkland that's conched for 72 hours.
Wow.
And again, you have people who know their craft, and then you have people who, they are their craft. Mm-hmm. These people are their craft. They understand from just the first sight of a bean and the first tasting of the raw bean what the end result is going to be.
Oh, that's just beautiful. That's really lovely.
So we had thought maybe we might want to go a little bit longer into maybe the 50-hour range. But then there's an aging process as well. Much like with wine, the longer it sits, the more it develops. Or much like a great gumbo. It's always better the next day.
To what level does that go? Because there must be an end point in aging and developing.
Well, again, it all depends on the profile you are looking to achieve. Then there is also the anticipation that if we let it sit for another month in solid form, it will wake up, it will brighten up, it will come to full maturity. At this point, it's ready to use.
It's exquisite. What really strikes me is this incredibly deep flavor on the palate that is something that you get when you have an extraordinary wine at exactly its perfect time.
And you haven't even had lost the finished product.
I have really never had a chocolate experience like this before.
Good.
And so
excellent.
Thank you for honoring me with this wonderful, amazing treat.
The honor and the pleasure was entirely mine.
And I know all of our Louisiana Eats listeners can't wait to come and taste too. So.
Well, I cannot wait to play with this and to show New Orleans and the world what incredible chocolate can do for you.
Well, please come back and visit us sometime soon.
I definitely will.
Chef Tarik Hanna of Sucre. Whether your holiday meal involves a standing beef rib, a goose, or even a turkey, my great-grandmother's peas in a roux are the perfect accompaniment for any roasted meat. This is a recipe I've never found in a cookbook, but over the years I've discovered it's tied to many a heartstring in Louisiana. Some people have told me they remember it as a Depression-era meal. The dark, rich flavor of the roux, when combined with peas and rice, made for a meatless meal when times were hard and money was scarce. For many years, I used frozen peas, believing them to be superior to canned. But not so long ago, that big display of canned petit pois peas convinced me to give Mama's original recipe a try, and the old school ingredient triumphed. Just make a dark roux by stirring together flour and oil, or bacon grease if you've got it. When the roux reaches milk chocolate brown, add a finely chopped onion. Sprinkle on a teaspoon of sugar and then add the can of petit pois peas, liquid and all. Season the peas with salt and cayenne pepper, stir it well, and let it simmer. Just before serving, enrich the peas with a couple of tablespoons of butter. If you make peas in a roux, you won't even need a gravy, I promise. For a copy of this recipe, visit our Louisiana Eats website at wwno.org. I'm Poppy Tooker, and my Mama's peas in a roux are real Louisiana Eats. When we come back from a short break, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Editor Jill Benson takes us to Natchitoches for the Festival of Lights. Meat pies, anyone? Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Jill Benson is editor of Louisiana Kitchen and Culture magazine. So Jill makes it her business to personally experience all that our state has to offer. She wants her readers to know always exactly where to go, what to do, and what to eat when they get there. So Jill, tell me all about what goes on in Natchitoches at Christmas time.
Poppy, I recently returned from Natchitoches, and Christmas is big business in Natchitoches. On the Saturday before Thanksgiving, they light their annual holiday display. This was their 86th year of doing this, and it was started by the power company. That makes sense.
Of course it does. They want that meter going round and round.
It's all about the juice.
So that was in the 1920s, I guess, when things were just first getting wired.
It was in the 1920s, and their holiday display now encompasses the entirety of the historic district with particular concentration around the river. So it's really spectacular with these lights shining off the water. And Natchitoches is such a picturesque, beautiful old town, and it's scrubbed to absolute pristine cleanliness.
And there's 300,000 lights in the display?
300,000 lights, and then they have 100 artistic displays scattered around town, again, with a concentration around the river, and all of those are lit up as well.
So what does that mean? What's an artistic display
for
Natchitoches?
There might be Santa, or maybe it's a sleigh, or an outdoor art installation. There are all sorts of things there.
Is there anything in the Cane River itself?
I think I saw Santa pulling a sleigh in the river. Perhaps he was on the riverbanks. But when they threw the switch the Saturday before Thanksgiving, they started it off with this massive fireworks display. And General Russell Henry was the master of ceremonies, and he was greeted with great fanfare. It seems that no matter what your political affiliation is, he manages to reach across the aisle. Everyone loves General Henry. Really, people follow him around greeting him as though he's Mick Jagger. This is what's so interesting to me about this holiday display, though. The population of Natchitoches is about 18,000 people.
Uh-huh.
This swells by an additional 30,000 the night that they light the Christmas display. And then the first weekend of December is their actual Christmas festival, when the town packs in an additional 100,000 people.
But Jill, where do all those people stay?
Well, hold on. We're not finished. over the course of 6 weeks that this Christmas celebration goes on, it's estimated that they bring in 500,000 people.
So where did you stay when you were there?
I stayed at Maison Louisiane, and this was an interesting story. It's an historic structure. It's a beautiful old Victorian home, and it had fallen into disrepair and had been ignored, and it was acquired by the bank. And a lawyer by the name of Dan Dice bought the building about 4 months ago. And in 2 months, he pumped about $300,000 into this and turned it around in 2 months.
Well, I guess if you know you've got 500,000 people potentially coming to sleep over, it gives you a lot of impetus to get a move on.
You're motivated. Absolutely. And I was really impressed with this place because full respect was paid to the architectural gifts of this building. But the best part is the innkeeper. She's this young woman. She's 22 years old. She must be the youngest and most beautiful innkeeper in the state of Louisiana. Her name is Tiffany Hudson. And she was working on a degree in HRT and marketing at Northwestern University. She wrote a marketing plan. It was a fictitious marketing plan on Maison Louisiane because it was unoccupied. It had fallen into disrepair. And she wrote about how she would bring it back and revitalize it, what she would do to market it. Picked up an A for the class, left, and moved to Shreveport. And then about 3 months ago, just by chance, strangers put her together with Dan Dice, and she now has her dream job of implementing this plan with this man to bring this building that she was so impassioned by back to life, and they're doing an amazing job. She's a wonderful cook. So the food that you have at this bed and breakfast is rather extraordinary.
Well, it sounds like maybe Tiffany's a psychic, too.
It could be.
That's just amazing. Speaking of food, I bet you there were some yummy things to eat.
There were some yummy things to eat. Lazione's is a perennial favorite in Natchitoches, known for their meat pies, of course. And interesting thing about Lazione's meat pies is they're actually going into commercial production. They'll be selling them at ballpark facilities throughout the country. And that's a little mom-and-pop operation that started up a long time ago. It's a little rags-to-riches story, and they've done very, very well. They have a crawfish pie on the menu now, too.
Yum.
And Lazione's, as usual, is just absolutely packed to the rafters. When I was there, I had the meat pie and dirty rice plate, and it was served with this delicious gravy. And you pour the gravy over everything, and then you retire to your room and clutch your stomach. But my favorite thing that I had to eat when I was there, my friend Iris Harper turned me on to this. It's called the Wookie, and it's at the pub in downtown Natchitoches. And it's a pile of hand-cut French fries slathered with brisket debris, and then heaps of melted cheese on top of that.
Oh, it sounds like something that could sustain the whole football team up there.
Indeed, I believe it could.
Now, tell me about the snow hill.
Poppy, the snow hill is really, this is unbelievable. It's 110 feet of snow, and it's in Natchitoches, and it's on the banks of Cane River Lake, which is just such a beautiful, picturesque body of water. And it's surrounded by all these beautiful old Victorian homes. And picture this with all these sparkling Christmas lights over the river. And then there's this 110-foot snow pile there on the riverbank.
And I understand that there's also an animated holiday light show.
That is new this year. And it happens every hour, 6:30 through 9:30. On the hour, they do a big animated light show. It's a 12-minute dancing show, and it's on the downtown bridge over Cane River Lake. And that connects the newer part of town to this historic district. And that runs through January 6th nightly, along with the rest of the holiday celebration.
And Jill, all of this incredible Christmas fun is free once you get there.
It is absolutely free, and the entire town of Natchitoches participates. So while the bulk of this is around the historic district, people really take pride in this. All of the homes are beautifully decked out for Christmas. There's caroling everywhere in their little parks and squares. There are lots of different things going on, little impromptu celebrations with a holiday theme. This is a great Louisiana freebie.
Well, I'm jumping in the car and getting on the trail of lights, meat pie in hand.
Don't forget those Wookie fries, Poppy. Stop at the pub for the Wookie.
Thanks, Jill. Jill Benson, editor of Louisiana Kitchen and Culture magazine. Educator Brian Berkey of the Wine Institute of New Orleans is one of the most well-schooled wine authorities in the U.S. Certified by both the French Wine Society and the Wine Academy of Spain, he is just the person to help us select that holiday gift of wine. Brian, welcome back to Louisiana Eats.
Oh, thank you.
We all face this problem during the holidays. You're going to a party, you'd like to bring a bottle of wine as a gift, but you don't have a clue what the tastes of the host is. So what do you do?
This is an amazing question, one which virtually everyone has to face. But I want to kind of back up a little bit and talk about what you just said. You're going to bring a gift to the host, and it doesn't really matter what it is or how you arrived at it. It's a gift for the host. And you should really take a lot of pressure off yourself about that. Because believe me, being in the wine business, people are freaked to try to give you a bottle of wine. I think the best way to approach this is to have some connection to the wine yourself. Don't worry about making their connection and having some inside knowledge about what they like. Instead, pick a wine, maybe the wine you had on your honeymoon, maybe the first wine that got you excited about wine, just as simple as a wine you really like. This is one of my favorite wines. Bang. You just hit a home run.
When it comes to wines, unless someone is very well schooled in wine or it's a particularly inexpensive label that somebody could recognize, the gift of wine is almost what they call in the retail world blind, because so often you're not really sure what the value of the bottle of wine is.
Oh, absolutely. Which actually, you just described why I started to study wine. My father-in-law is very generous. He's a fantastic man and loves great tastes, and introduced me to very expensive wines, to which I was very appreciative of, but could not ever afford if he wasn't around. and would go into wine shops and go, wow, that bottle's 80 and that bottle's 8. Why? You know, and had no idea why. Had no idea why. And I was very intimidated to talk to people. I said, I'm going to go find out, and read lots of books. And this is now many years and a long journey away. But that was really the impetus. I wanted to know what the magic was between these things that you couldn't see any difference of.
Well, you know, something that I have heard you tell people before, one of the reasons to get educated about wine is so that you can appreciate an expensive wine. Isn't that so?
It's a little more complicated than just that. Everyone likes really sort of generic things. You know, it's like, oh, I like that. Does anybody love that sort of generic thing? Well, no, maybe they don't have a passion for it. And instead, it's that specific thing. It's that particular thing that you have that great passion for. And fine wines become like that because they're not like anything else. They have their own very distinct personality. And that's kind of what you're paying for. And less expensive wine, there's a lot more of it. It's a lot more general. It's not very specific. It's sort of like one wine is very like the other wine, and thus the price is not pushed up.
Does it make any difference, or is there a thought that should go into bringing a gift of wine to someone you know is a confirmed vegetarian or vegan?
Okay. Wine is a vegetable or a fruit, I think of it as. And it is super, super rare today. So there's never any animal product left in the wine ever. It's all gone. But there are very minute chances that they can use this a fish product that will be used to remove some tannin. It's never there. But you could ask and say, do you know if this has been processed with any animal? And usually the answer is no.
What is your favorite wine to bring to a party?
My favorite wine to bring to a party is sparkling wine. It says celebration. And, you know, it's really the one wine that kind of opens with a pop, you know?
Well, name drop. Give me some price points, some average price points, and some labels that people should be looking for.
If I do tell you, I mean, there's the Schaffenberger, which is a California sparkling wine, should retail around $15 a bottle, made from Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, the exact process of champagne. Doesn't quite taste like champagne when you have it next to next, but very, very good, and I drink it a lot. There's another one from Argentina that I actually know is hard to get. It's called Toso, T-O-S-O. They do some particular things that are very nice. It's also around $15. So some come and go. I can think of three or four that I can get for 3 weeks, and then I can't get for 2 months, and then I can get them for a week. So I would tell people who are hung up on a brand or a specific thing to ask for help, ask for something similar, and try it. You might like it better. It's highly unlikely that you will like it less.
How about some disasters? Do you have any terrible no-nos of what not to do?
My terrible no-nos on what not to do are actually with the receiver of the gift and not the giver. Time and time again, someone is given a very nice bottle of wine and they never drink it. They are in somehow just in fear. I mean, I have talked to people who have inherited these bottles. Well, this was given to my parents who never really did wine, and they were afraid to open it. I was like, oh, my God, that's just a tragedy. First of all, the wine is not any good anymore because it's been 30 years, but it's an experience that they should have had. You know, it was an experience that was being given to them. So to not open them thinking that maybe their special moment will once upon a time happen, that special moment is going to be next Friday night. That is going to be when that next special moment is going to be.
Well, this is so much good advice. I really hope that Santa's listening and all the elves who were worried about this question, I hope they've tuned in too. And I want to thank you so much for coming to talk with us at Louisiana Eats, Brian.
Oh, thank you.
Brian Berkey of the Wine Institute of New Orleans. After the next short break, food historian Ryan Fertel joins us to debunk the myths that surround the 19th century praline vendor. Wait till you hear the truth behind that storybook image. Don't go anywhere. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. Louisiana Eats culinary heritage heroes are farmers, fishers, chefs, and food producers who bring an authentic taste of our state's heritage to the world's tables. This week's hero is the inspirational head of a vital Louisiana food bank. Under her guidance, an 85,000 square foot community kitchen was built, capable of producing 10,000 meals a day.
Well, you know, in the greater New Orleans area, 32,000 children are eligible for free and reduced breakfast and lunch programs. So we kind of use that as a barometer of what kind of need is out there, because only 13% of those children were also participating in summer feeding programs. So we wanted to make a big dent in the summer feeding program, and I think that the numbers are going to show that we were able to increase that percentage substantially.
After initiating a successful feeding program in 2011, our hero went a step further to address the problem of childhood hunger by serving after-school dinners.
Our chef went into this whole endeavor thinking that, he was not going to fry any chicken. He was not going to send out any pizzas, you know, things that we all think that children enjoy. And of course they do. I mean, don't we all? So he had whole wheat spaghetti going out. He would put spinach into things in order to give it some, you know, additional nutritional value. And I will tell you, I don't know of one comment that came back where the kids weren't willing to eat this more nutritious style lunch than they may have been used to. So it's a great experiment, and it seems to have fully succeeded.
Knowing that in Louisiana, not just children, but one in every eight people struggle with hunger, our hero reached out to the elderly of our state.
We're particularly concerned about our seniors because often that's the silent face of hunger. They're not speaking out. Many times they're very proud and don't want to come and ask for help. And we know if we're going to think about what we need to be focused on, it's going to have to be the aging of our population, the number of baby boomers that will be retiring soon, and how we're going to reach out and serve them if they experience the issue of hunger.
That's why Natalie Jarrow of the Second Harvest Food Bank of Greater New Orleans and Acadiana is this week's Louisiana Eats Culinary Heritage Hero, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. You can be a hero, too, by making a donation to the Second Harvest Food Bank. Visit them online at nohunger.org to learn how. Congratulations, Natalie, and thank you for your efforts to ensure that everyone in Louisiana eats. Images of 19th century New Orleans are filled with tignon-wearing praline sellers offering crispy sugar patties from great woven baskets on the streets of the French Quarter. As the closing speaker of the Historic New Orleans Collection Symposium on Pralines, food historian and scholar Ryan Fertel promised to turn the historical praline world upside down with his theories on the authenticity of those classic images. Ryan, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Thank you, Poppy. It's so great to be here.
Okay, now give us a little praline history.
Well, it's hard to get at what is the history of pralines, at least in the city. Some stories, some myths place them at almost the founding of New Orleans. So,
they seem to be synonymous. New Orleans pralines.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of, I call it the Creole confectionery. It's like it's so omnipresent here. It's so tied into the history and culture of the city. So there's some myths saying that they were brought in, you know, as early as the early 18th century with the settlement of the city. We got to remember that it ties ingredients from all over the Atlantic world. So sugar from the Caribbean, pecans and milk locally. It's most likely a French invention. And it also incorporates all those things that aren't so tangible from all around the Atlantic Ocean. So history, languages, race.
So however in the whole world the confection gets here, it suddenly in the 19th century becomes very prevalent in the lore, and certainly in old woodcuts and imagery. We see that praline seller again and again, don't we?
We do, especially in histories, in tales of 19th century antebellum New Orleans, but tales and histories that are published in the early 20th century. They always portray the praliniere, the African-American woman selling pralines on the streets of antebellum New Orleans, However, looking at accounts from the 19th century, there's nothing. There's no accounts of women selling pralines out of baskets before the Civil War.
So when did you see the first accounts of this pralinière in print?
Well, all the accounts happen in postbellum New Orleans after the Civil War.
Ah, around 18...
Well, you really start to see them in the 1870s, 1880s. You start to see a lot of traveler accounts in the 1890s. They're describing the streetscape of New Orleans and how it's changed since the war. And it did change a lot. You had African-American women who had more freedom to sell items on the streets, confections, maybe other dishes like gumbo. There's one instance of that in the historical record. It's really after the Civil War that women and men are able to have a business, to express themselves on the streets of New Orleans by cooking and selling food.
One of the things that stuck with me from this symposium was your term, the praline seller economy. What was that?
Sure. So the praline and other candies that were being sold by African-American women on the streets of New Orleans provided these women with an economic freedom and independence. By selling candy, women were able to build a career, build a business. They were able to buy a home. They were able to raise a family.
And I recall you talking about how sometimes they were even playing with their imagery, or they were playing into the imagery. Explain that.
Sure. So the praline seller or praliniere, it's in all types of histories for the past 150 years of the city. Typically, it's what we'd recognize as the mammy.
Uh-huh.
So the mammy image. So a tignon, it would be a kind of bigger woman in a dress. She would be kind of safe in a way.
There's a comforting sense.
She's comforting. She's motherly.
Uh-huh.
But these women, because they were business owners selling their recipes on the street, selling their candy on the streets of New Orleans, they were smart enough, they're intelligent enough to play into this imagery, which was prevalent even then. This what we associate later with Gone with the Wind, this moonlight magnolias myth, that was being played, that was being sold to tourists and to Southerners immediately after the Civil War. And these women would dress like that. They'd play into the myth. They'd play into the stories being created by white men to sell pralines.
So this imagery, in essence, became a marketing tool for them.
It was a marketing tool, yeah.
That's pretty fascinating.
And we could see that in the praline shops in the quarter today. That mammy image is prevalent, either in signs, within the shops, on the packaging itself.
It's amazing how that, I imagine the rest of the country must sometimes sort of tilt their head at us, like, what's that about, huh?
Well, it's not just the rest of the country. I mean, also people born here.
Yeah, well, yeah, particularly younger generations. I mean, this is a taboo, and somehow it's still being perpetuated.
It's being perpetuated, but at the same time, it was perpetuated by the women themselves for all the right reasons. That is, to make some money, to build a career, to raise a family, to build a home by selling pralines.
Okay, now I have to tell you, really my favorite part of the symposium was your talk. And there were two things that you brought up. So you did all this research and, you know, you began to find the accounts of the praline sellers. And you had these totally wackadoodle names that you came up with that you found in history for what they were calling the candy. Would you talk to us about that?
Sure. So if you look at pictures of pralines over the decades, color pictures, you'll see three distinct colors. You'll see the kind of brown or tannish, khaki-colored pralines that we know and see everywhere. Then you see a pink confection, similarly shaped, sometimes a little bit differently, and you'll see a white one too.
And they had special names.
Looking at the picayune, I did a search. You type in the word praline, it's like a Google search. And you get every use of the word praline. So in the 1880s and 1890s, pralines are all over the Picayune. People are talking about them all the time. This is people that work for the Picayune. This is reporters on the street. And these are traveler accounts. Back then, people would, when they'd come to New Orleans, they'd write about it and they'd send it to the paper. So I found a traveler account from February 1880, a man named Alex Porter Morse. And Alex Porter Morse was from the area, but he had long ago, before the war, moved to Washington, D.C. And he had visited in maybe late 79, early 1880. He hadn't been back in New Orleans for 3 years. And he said that when he visited New Orleans in the late 1870s, that last time, he said it was this wretched place. It was awful. The people were despondent. I mean, it was a just depressed city suffering the effects of the Civil War.
Yeah, so post-Civil War sounds like post-Katrina, huh?
In a way, right. In a way. But he comes back in late 79, 1880. He publishes this letter, and he says that New Orleans is transformed. He says he doesn't even recognize the city. And he mentions some specific things, and one of them is the street, the scenes from the streets, and he loved to walk the streets. And he said that he saw vendors on the streets for the first time in his life on the streets of New Orleans. He said he saw men selling Italian oranges. He said there were Acadian turkey farmers.
Acadian turkey farmers.
Right, so Cajun turkey farmers. And he said they were marchands, which is a French word for seller, vendor, merchant of flowers, pralines, white mice, and poodles along Canal Street.
Okay, so white mice and poodles? Like, what's that about?
Okay, well, I think it's important that he kind of separates these three candies. He says there's pralines, white mice, and poodles. I'm a historian. I'm a trained historian. I'm finishing my PhD. Historians, academics like to think and say that they live on facts, but we also live by conjecture. And so I'm going to conjecture a bit.
Okay.
I think the white mice were the white praline-shaped candies, those coconut candies. Mice are somewhat praline-shaped, or pralines are somewhat mouse-shaped. So those maybe were the white mice. Maybe that is what they were called in the 19th and early 20th century.
Okay, I'm buying that. And how about the poodle?
All right, poodles. I did a bit of research on poodles, poodle history, poodle culture in 19th century America.
Oh, where food history will lead you, huh?
Right, exactly. So poodles were immensely popular, not so much to own in America in the late 19th century, but they were show dogs, and not in the sense that we know now. But they were kind of circus dogs. There'd be traveling poodle shows. There'd be poodles in costume that you'd pay to see. There'd be poodles that could do tricks. There was a famous poodle who would travel around Europe, and most of this poodle culture came from England, France, Victorian Europe. There was a poodle who could read and write. There was one poodle who could understand 17 languages or something.
Oh, yeah. My pugs do that, too.
Right. So they're dressing up poodles as ballerinas, as school children. They're also painting poodles. They're dyeing the coats of poodles. One of the most popular colors for poodles, of course, was pink.
Yes.
And you'd have show dogs. You'd have troops of traveling pink poodles doing tricks, dancing, walking on two legs, traveling around America. This is a time of P.T. Barnum, of the traveling circus. It's my thought that New Orleanians saw these pink poodles, the cuteness of it, and named this pink candy, this dyed pink candy, after the pink poodle.
Oh, Ryan, I just love your theories. This is delicious and such a sweet story, if I can say so. Thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you.
Food writer, scholar, and praline detective, Ryan Purtell. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we return with a look back at some of our favorite guests from this past year.
People want to get in the kitchen, and food is becoming one of those things that people are embracing more and more, but it's sometimes too complicated. And I wanted to let people know, like, get in the kitchen with your kids, get in the kitchen with your friends, have a good time with your brother like I do on the show, and just take good food and keep it simple and simplify, but have it full of flavor.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's. Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company, Leitzegan Funeral Homes, and our media sponsor, Louisiana Kitchen and Culture Magazine. Theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes, produced at Piety Street Recording. Thanks to producer and sound engineer Thomas Walsh and our editor, Zoe Sullivan. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO.